Sandy Tudegator and Ira Rothstein. And I hope I don't annoy anybody with the title. By pedestrian, I actually meant myself. I didn't really understand what's in the literature about representation of the conformal group until I went through this in this new fashion. And I hope this is actually something that helps you understand a piece of literature that is interesting but difficult. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start by giving you a little bit of motivation from on particles. And then I'm going to talk about the unitary representation of the conformal group. I'm not going to actually quote from the paper of Mack. I'm just going to derive some of the results of Mack's paper, the classic paper. And I hope there's enough in there that you understand where the results are coming from. And then in the last bit of the talk, I'm going to apply some of that to what's appeared in the on particle literature. In particular, you know, what dimensions are allowed, why scale invariance alone doesn't cure the problems that they face, and then some of the contact terms that people have been ignoring that you're forced to when you understand the properties of the conformal representation. So consider a theory which has a beta function that looks like this. Remember, the beta function tells you how the coupling constant runs. The derivative of the coupling constant with respect to, logarithmically with respect to scale, is the beta function. And suppose that this beta function is negative and then it turns positive, crossing at some point with value g equal to g star. And imagine that I want to see how this, how to solve this equation. When I start with an initial condition that g is some tiny value here. So I'm going to call that initial tiny value g of m. And because this value is tiny, the beta function itself is very small, which tells you that g is basically constant. So as I make mu smaller than capital M, nothing much happens to g. So g, I start with g of m as a small value here, and nothing much happens to it. It remains constant. But it really, because its beta is negative, it's really kind of moving to the right, growing a little bit as mu decreases. And all of a sudden, beta starts becoming large, or different from zero. And as that happens, this tells you that g starts changing rapidly, and it quickly rolls over to the other side, which is representing this equation like that in this plot. With this quick, big step. And then it gets very close to g star, where the beta function vanishes. So again, it becomes a constant, and it just remains a constant at that value. There's a transition region, which I call lambda, which is where the quick rollover occurs. And below that scale lambda, the beta function vanishes. The value of the coupling constant is constant equal to g star. The theory is largely scaled invariant because the beta function is zero. If there's no actual masses, hard masses given to this in the Lagrangian, but still you may have large non-zero anomalous dimensions. The Banach-Zaks theory, which I'm going to refer to several times, is an example of these where you can actually do computations. The beta function you can write as an expansion in powers of the coupling constant, the loop expansion. And what Banach-Zaks allows you to do is to find a solution here for the beta function being zero at a value of g which is still perturbative. In other words, you make the one loop term artificially small so that it's of the order of the second or the two loop term, and they both feel much larger than the three loop and above. So that's my quick introduction to what scale invariance theories are. Of course, I'll tell you later a little bit more about this, but basically, if you write down a scale invariant theory, you automatically get a conformal invariant theory. Now, conformal field theories don't have traditional S-matrix descriptions. You can't write down asymptotic states that correspond to particles. And George I wrote a couple of intriguing papers where he asked the question, if there's a conformal field theory and I don't know how to computer, you know, I don't have an S matrix. I don't understand what's happening with my intuition brought over from particle physics. I'd like to know how I would be able to probe this theory or to make tests on this theory with detectors that I can, you know, find in my shop in the experimental labs. So how do I do that? So his idea was, well, let's actually couple normal particles, like the standard model particles, to a conformal field theory weakly. And I'll tell you what weakly means in a second. And then let's use scattering of normal particles, standard model particles, to investigate these conformal field theories. And what he found is that, well, he considered two kinds of probing of conformal field theory using standard model particles. One is to do standard model particle scattering, say electron-electron scattering, going to electron-electron, where somehow in the intermediate process, the conformal field theory plays a role. And another kind of thing that he considered was the production of conformal field theory stuff. So you take E plus E minus into this stuff and ask, what happens? Can you see that? And is it different? And he found interesting stuff. He found that the production of, which is the second of these examples, the production is as if the final state had a phase space that is not that of an integer number of particles, but a fractional number. And that's where the number, the name on particles comes from, because they're not like particles. And also, he found that for just scattering of particles to particles, the virtual effects of the conformal field theory gives you angular distributions and momentum dependence, which is kind of very different from the normal. So you would actually be able to test for such a thing this way. Now, what do I mean by weak coupling? This is going to be kind of important for understanding this, the rest, so let me spend a little bit of time on this. What we're going to do is we're going to couple the standard model to the conformal field theory only through relevant operators. In other words, dimensions, operators in four dimensions, operators of dimensions higher than four. So there's a scale in front of the operator that makes the coupling really small at low energies. This makes conformal invariance safe. In other words, this, as you go to the infrared, these operators that could, in principle, destabilize these theories from being scale invariant become totally relevant, and the theory remains scale invariant. Now, in order to do this and to have a renormalizable theory, you want to have some sort of UV completion. And the UV completion basically corresponds to taking some new particle, some very heavy particle, call it a messenger, that couples the standard model particle, this is just generic for anything in the standard model, to operators in your conformal field theory. And the last thing we want is, although it's really not very central to the whole story, but Georgia insisted on this, in order to be able to compute things, you'd like this conformal field theory to be a Banach type theory so you can actually compute stuff. Now, so you get basically at the scale of this messenger, you can construct an effective theory by integrating out these messengers, and then the effective Hamiltonian would look something like some Banach operator on this side multiplied by a standard model operator from that side, and some power of the mass of the messenger, depending on what type of messenger you have, and a coefficient, which I labeled as C of M, because now I can imagine running this effective theory to low energies, and I will assume always that this mass is larger than the scale lambda at which the theory here goes conformal, so that at this scale M, I can do all my computations perturbatively, and then I can run to low energies. And as I run to low energies, what happens is I kind of stop running at the scale where the theory goes conformal. I'm going to ignore the standard model interactions, which are not relevant here, and only consider the interactions of the conformal field theory. And the operator, has some anomalous dimension. And this thing with a hat, which I'll use later, is the operator times the power of mu so that it is a scale invariant. And when I go backwards. Okay. So if you want to study 2-to-2 scattering of normal particles, you would have something like two particles come in, this local operator that I just produced for you, it makes some conformal field theory stuff. Then the conformal field theory stuff does the opposite. It goes to the same interaction back to normal particles, and that gives you the process you want. Notice that in order to compute this, since the standard model particles are basically non-interacting, you need a time order product, the vacuum expectation value of the time order product of two conformal field operators. And if you want on particle production, it's the same thing. You just have to take a cut through this diagram. So it's the same two-point function that you need. Now, the interesting thing is that to explain to you a simple, in simple terms where the conditions for unitary representations of the conformal group come from, all I need to do is look at those two-point functions that I'm probing with my standard model particles and require that the standard model cross-sections satisfy standard or amplitude satisfy conditions that you're familiar with, for example, unitarity. In particular, what I'm going to have to do is to require that the optical theorem holds. In fact, actually, something much simpler, that the imaginary part of the forward scattering amplitude is positive and or non-negative. So here's what I'm going to do for you very quickly. I'm going to tell you about these two-point Green's functions. They actually determine in X space by conformal invariants. Then I'm going to compute propagators, just take the Fourier transforms of these things, not very very deep. And then I'm going to use those propagators to compute the forward scattering amplitudes and take the imaginary part. And then imagine the optical theorem will give me the conditions that that correspond to max conditions on the representation of unitary representation of conformal group. Okay. So consider the scalar propagator. You take a scalar operator times a scalar operator. The two-point function in a scale invariant theory has to go like 1 over x squared to the d, where d is the dimension of the operator. It was not very deep, but that's all it takes, in fact. This constant here I cannot determine just from symmetry properties, obviously, because I can renormalize the state, the operator, and get a different constant. But you can see that it's going to have to be positive just by comparing the left to the left side. I'll prove that later very explicitly for you. Now consider the vector. The vector might be a little bit of a surprise to some of you. Scale invariants would tell you that it goes like 1 over x squared to the d times a tensor, which is a linear combination of g mu nu or x mu nu over x squared. But the tensor that I brought here has a relative size of 1 to minus 2 in these two terms. That comes from requiring invariants under special conformal transformations. And although it is a three-line proof, I'm not going to do that for you in the interest of time. An interesting observation is the divergence of this thing is 0 only when d is equal to 3. So these currents here can be conserved only when the dimension of the current is 3. That is not a big surprise if you think about the fact that conserved currents have zero anomalous dimensions. And you can keep doing this. I'm not going to do it for fermions, but you can do that for spinors in general. You can do that with gamma matrices. But for tensors, you basically use this basic tensor and just combine it in symmetric and anti-symmetric representations, take away traces, and keep going. So you have all of the ingredients necessary for the two-point functions. We're doing four dimensions, remember. For those of you who've lived too long in two dimensions, this is not different. Okay, step two, let's take the Fourier transform. Well, Fourier transform is just dimensional analysis, although you can get the numbers here, and you can actually do this from scratch and check that this is valid in some region of D and then analytically continue. And then in order to get those for vectors, I'm not going to ask you to memorize these. I just want to show you that we did some work, actually. You just take derivatives of this first line, and then you can get these propagators. Notice the structure of these propagators. You don't get g mu nu minus k mu k nu over k squared. You get that only when d is equal to 3, but that's what I said before, that for d equal to 3, you get conserved currents. For any other d, this is not a transverse vector. Same thing happens for the tensor, although you cannot see that right away because it's a bit more complicated. Now, that was done in Euclidean space. You can do the usual rotation to Minkowski space. The only reason I'm pointing this out here is that you get this minus k squared minus I epsilon inside the power of d minus 3, which is kind of weird, but you can live with that. Okay, step 3 and 4 I'll do in one shot. So remember what we're trying to do is probe the CFT with external particles which don't interact. And now what I'm going to do is require that the imaginary part of the forward scattering amplitude be non-negative. And, you know, this thing is just going to be the two-point function that we've been studying. So, for example, imagine it doesn't even have to be this planar model. I'm going to take a Lagrangian into which I for the conformal field theory into which I include a coupling to an external source. I'm going to call it chi. And I put a coupling constant g, I don't know why, plus the Hermitian conjugate. And then, so this is chi, this is the source, and you have the complex conjugate of the source here. So the amplitude goes like the source square times the propagator, which is this constant Cs, and this thing that you saw from the previous transparency. And if you take the imaginary part of these, you get this nice expression where everything is positive except possibly the factor of Cs and d minus 1, which I extracted here. Now, I promise I was going to show you that Cs has to be positive. It's kind of obvious. If you integrate over x and take this, you get the square of this operator. So integrate over x over a compact support, then you get that this is positive, and that means that Cs is positive. So that's a very trivial argument. And it's true for the tensors and the vectors and all that, so I won't repeat it. But therefore, the previous transparency just gives you the dimension of the operators has to be of scale operators has to be greater than 1. And that's the first of the results of MAC. But you can do this again and again. Let's do it for the vectors. Again, let me take a source chi mu, couple it to the vector operator O mu, and compute the forward scattering amplitude. You get some result that looks like this. And now it gets kind of interesting. You get these two terms. And chi, remember, is totally arbitrary. So I can take the components, consider them separately. So let me actually look at this thing in the rest frame of this momentum k, which makes this easier because you see k, you see this picks up the zero component. So I combine the zero components and I get this and the vector components that. And now these components and those are arbitrary. So I get that this thing is positive and this coefficient d3 minus over d minus 3 over d minus 1 is positive also. Okay. So this almost tells you that d is bigger than 3, but there's a window between 1 and 3 that, between 0 and 1, I'm sorry, that I have to exclude. And that's excluded from the fact that you want the amplitude to not diverge for an arbitrary well-behaved source. The amplitudes do not diverge, and that excludes, in fact, anything below d equal to 2. D this happens generically. The term with the highest spin in the propagator is the one that gives you that type of highest restriction. So you get, in fact, that the dimension of a vector has to be at least 3. Okay, I'm going to skip this because I think I'm going to run out of time. But you can actually, let me just mention it very briefly. Things happen that are particularly interesting when you are at the boundary, when d is equal to 1 for scalars or when d is equal to 3 for vectors. And the things that happen that are interesting, we've already seen for vectors, it's at d equal 3 that the current is conserved. For d equal 1, what happens, which is interesting, is that you get a delta function of k squared here, which means that the operator satisfies this condition, which means that there's no descendants. The descendants have zero norm. So people who know conformal field theory know that result, but that's where it comes from, which is kind of very simple here. And these results generalize in a fairly straightforward way. I want to spend a little bit of time on how this applies to unparticles, and I have 10 minutes left. So if you have questions about the representations themselves, I'm going to go back to that later. So some simple observations. In the unparticle literature, you'll find that people study only the range of dimensions between 1 and 2. That there are statements that integral dimensions ought to be avoided because things blow up there. And that this region between 1 and 2 is applied to all fields regardless of spin. Well, I already showed you that, first of all, there's no reason to cut this at 2. There's no upper bound on d. Secondly, there's nothing special in integral values of d. There's some subtleties. I'll show you that. But everything is well defined. And three, you can't use this region unless you're for vector fields or for tensor fields. In fact, only scalars are allowed to have dimensions smaller than 2. Okay. So when I say that the lower bound depends on J1, J2, by J1 and J2, I mean the Lorentz representation of the field, 1/2, 1/2 for the vector. And I think the reason people study this region only, although I can't guess why, but I think, is because if d is bigger than 2, the effects of unparticles become irrelevant and quickly uninteresting. But as I show you, you can't do that with vectors. So, okay. Now, one thing that you may have seen in the literature is the claim that, well, that's conformal invariance puts too strong restriction on these theories. All we want is scale invariance. But I don't think that's a way out. First of all, there's no known examples of four-dimensional theories which are scale invariant but not conformal invariant and unitary. It's very easy to come up with examples that are scale invariant but not conformal invariant if they are non-unitary. I can give you some over drinks later. In two dimensions, Polchinski has actually proven this statement. And although people often point back to Riva and Cardi's counterexample, the counterexample is non-unitary, and the authors point this out. If you only use scale invariance in any case, the condition that I used in an early transparency about convergence of the amplitude translates into this. In other words, for vectors, where J1 and J2 are 1/2, this condition, I'll remind you because I had it there, is that the dimension be greater than 2. And you cannot get around that one. Okay. A couple more comments. I have two different comments on contact terms. This one is very trivial, but very dangerous. Remember that we had this way of introducing the interaction between the standard model and the conformal field theory. And this gives rise to some sort of effective Lagrangian, which has a coupling of some sort of standard model operator to a conformal field theory operator. And I wrote those as currents, but they don't have to be. But then you can't avoid having, if you have this, you can't avoid coupling this thing back to the standard model itself. And if you do that, you're going to get an operator with one power of whatever power you had here, 1 over mu squared. You can have one power of the standard model coupling to itself. There might be some higher dimension operator with more derivatives, with more powers. But remember, to do some scattering of standard model particles to standard model particles, you're going to need this thing twice.
So it's going to go like 4 powers of the scale mu. I think I have this in the district. Yeah, here it is.
So say e plus e minus to e plus e minus goes like 1 over mu squared times 1 over mu squared, whereas this contact interaction goes like 1 power of 1 over mu squared. So the on-particle mediator to the direct contact term is suppressed by powers of e over m, which is very, it's not a disaster if you're interested in non-particles. All you have to do is first discover the effects of this thing, because they're going to show up first. They're bigger. Once you found those, then go look for the small effects that come from that. That's OK. But these things actually have been studied. They've been studied at Aleph and also at the Tevatron. But I have here some of the results by Aleph. Basically, all I want you to look at is the fact that this is e plus e minus to any kind of fermion bilinear. It's characterized by some scale lambda. Here are the bounds on those scales. Typically ordered, can you see that? I can see it from here. The scale here goes to 25 TeV. So you see the scale here is of the order of 10 to 20 TeV, depending on the specifics of the reaction. Contact terms number 2. This is a little bit more subtle. This is our vector propagator again. Remember that when d goes to 3, this becomes a nice transverse propagator. But if you look at this thing, this becomes a log. Actually, the log comes about because there's a pole. As d goes to 3, this gamma function gives you a pole. Now, the pole is not a lot of trouble. The pole itself gives you contact interaction. The delta function on this side, which you just subtract away. That's what renormalization is about. But then we're left with this logarithm. The scale of the logarithm is also irrelevant because, again, it gives rise to the same delta function. Now, this is not a big surprise. If you actually take a free field theory and make a fermion bilinear, which is a vector, and make a while loop diagram, you'll be computing the propagator between 2d equals 3 conformal field theory vectors. Because free fields are, that's an example of a conformal field theory. And you would get exactly this result. So there's nothing wrong about this. This is, by the way, the kind of divergences at integer dimensions that people are worried about in the particle literature. Well, there's nothing to worry about it, but you have to keep track of it. And the mu dependence is important. If you compute, for example, EE to mu mu, or EE to EE, the effective Hamiltonian from the on-particles has, well, the on-particle operator, like we've seen before. But then there's also a contact operator that comes in order 1 over mu to the 4 that I showed you before with 2 derivatives. And these things, what happens from that mu dependence is that these 2 operators mix on the renormalization. And this is the solution. All I wanted to show is that they, in fact, they do mix. And if they don't include the mixing, you're going to get results that are actually mu-dependent. So your scattering amplitude is going to depend on the realization point, which is nonsense. This, I show you this with d equal 3, but this result, actually, I wrote it for arbitrary dimension. So the scaling doesn't have to be at d equal 3. The problem occurs regardless of that. And my last little bit, I have 1 minute to go. My last little bit is the effect of propagators. In the on-particle literature, the propagators of vectors are always taken to be vectors. I mean,
vectors are taken to be vectors, that's true. They're taken to be transverse, as if they were conserved currents. Now, I show you that this is not the case unless the dimension is strictly 3. Of course, you wonder, why do I care? Because they actually do it for dimensions between 1 and 2 anyway, which are ruled out. But imagine that you say, well, let me investigate this at dimensions 3 and above. How would things change? Well, there's no physical distinction if this vector from the conformal theory is coupling to a conserved current in the standard model, because the extra term, the k mu k nu piece, doesn't contribute to an amplitude, since it just kills the standard model current, which is conserved. But if you couple this to a non-conserved current, then it makes a difference. And here's an example. A top quark decaying to a U or charm quark plus a non-particle. And here's the coupling. There's a vector coupling, vector current, V minus A for some reason, of the top quark to a lighter quark, coupling to a vector CFT operator. And now this is not a conserved current. And so what I've done here for you is the kind of error you make in the distribution. This is the energy distribution, or the spectrum of the decay of the top quark in units of the mass of the top over 2. And what I'm actually plotting here is the error, the percentage error you make when you ignore the correction to the propagator, the fact that the propagator is not exactly transverse. So this is the difference between the actual result and the one where you assume that the propagator is transverse. And you see these big, and the different lines here correspond to different dimensions, 3.2, 3.4, and so on for this operator. You see that the distinction can be large, 15, 20%, which is kind of important because you're going to discover on particles from their weird behavior, at least you should get their weird behavior correct. So the summary.
Well, I think I'm not going to read through that because you can read through yourself. But I basically show you that this, the representations of the conformal, the unitary representation of the conformal group, although the original literature is a little bit hard to read, you can actually understand it very easily by just applying the optical theorem. It's more like a physicist's way of understanding something. And you get some additional insights. For example, you understand better the tensor structure of propagators, and you get some idea of this generalization. Remember, these contact interactions that I pointed out are necessary for scale invariant. And as far as a particle is concerned, my summary is you have to be careful of having correct lower bounds on D, the dimension of the operators. You have to be careful about the operators, the vector operators, and tensor operators, and so on, not being transverse. You have to be careful the ultra-heavy particle exchange necessarily gives rise to contact interactions in the standard model. Actually, this is a somewhat model-dependent result. I think you can probably get around if you're very careful and very clever, but nobody has done that yet. And the CFT, this is related to this renormalization, but even if you could get around this problem, the CFT exchange itself induces additional standard model interactions, which have not been accounted for properly. And I'll take any questions.
Has anybody looked at using right-handed neutrinos as the messenger particle? And do you know if that would help you respect these bounds on contact interactions?
There's very little. I don't know the answer to your question. I mean, I have not seen a paper which does that. There's very little in the literature of studying the actual foundations of the theory. For example, what kind of messengers could you have, and what kind of constructions you could have to avoid some of these messenger problems. Most of what's in the literature is about using the effective coupling at low energies to produce new phenomenological signatures and trying to understand those signatures.
Naive question. You pointed out that you get contact interactions if you take the heavy particle exchange, but wouldn't they even be more dangerous for contact interactions in your conformal sector?
No, in the conformal sector, there still are irrelevant interactions. So as you go to the infrared, they don't destroy, if by dangerous you mean destroying the fact that you have a conformal fixed point, the answer is no, because as you go to the infrared, the irrelevant interactions become truly irrelevant. And they get suppressed by the energy, over the mass of the factor in front.
Any other questions? Okay, let us thank the speaker again then. We are done for today. We'll resume.